Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Please visit audiblepodcast.com/smartest for your free audiobook download.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Greg Proops.
Hearts and alarms, greetings, mellow greetings, Ookie Dookie. The Proopcast is once again in the ether, Proopcasting live on tape from the friendly confines of the Punchline Comedy Club here in my beloved San Francisco, California. Located high atop Alcoa Plaza in the bustling, throbbing epicenter of grooviness, the Financial District here in San Francisco. Others may seek bohemian climes, but we seek to broadcast from the very heart of evil. There is no debt ceiling here, only no limit to the mirth that may be enjoyed and endured on this night. We're so very excited to be here. I drove up from Los Angeles today on the I-5 highway, which many of the Proop kittens and Proop castanets and Proop castilians and Proop basques out there in the world will be going, what in heaven's name is the I-5, Greg? Well, people here in California are all too familiar with it. It's a straight road that runs about 500 miles between Northern California and Lower California. It runs through the part of the state where Barbara Boxer is considered a communist because she created a drought, apparently. And where the smell of bovine offal is almost overwhelming at certain points. Just outside of Coalinga, there's a confabulation of cows, the likes of which has not been seen since John Wayne in the movie The Undefeated. There are gabajillions of cows there, and the effluvium and flotsam from their malodorous rear ends is an overwhelming compliment to the food that is served at the Harris Ranch thereby. Driving in here tonight, of course, once again, the temperature was 91 degrees when we stopped in Coalinga. The temperature as I drove into San Francisco, a brisk 62. So, a 30-degree shift here. It's summertime in San Francisco, and that means it's bloody freezing at night, particularly up here two stories above the Financial District where a whipping wind comes by that chills the bone and runs right up your trouser leg, making your gonads seek refuge in an internal organ they have no business being in. I live in Los Angeles now, or Lower California, because I'm shallow and I want to be near Satan's cock at all times. And the thing is, once you live down there for a while, your blood gets thin because it's warm every day and it's warm every night. So when I come back to San Francisco, I have to remind myself to bring an overcoat, glove, and scarves for the summer. And that's our punishment that's visited down upon the tourists who come to this town, who are so unwise to visit us during July and August, they knowing nothing of Indian summer. When September and October, when it's most pleasant here, and July and August, when you stand outside and feel your shorts whipping around you as your fanny pack blows down Market Street, when you wait for that cable car. And why isn't anyone polite here? We don't have to be. Fuck you if you don't want to come back. San Francisco, it's different than your shitty town. For one thing, it's pretty, okay? And the food is awesome. Maybe that's why we're not as friendly as we fucking need to be. You go to the Midwest in Indiana, and as I've said before on the Proopcast, I was in Indiana, and I said, everyone's so nice here, and someone said to me, that's why it's called the Heartland, Greg. No one ever calls San Francisco the fucking Heartland, because it isn't. It's a peninsula adjacent to America, is what it is. Travel east 20 minutes if you want to find America, where country music plays all the time and shit like that. We know what we have here in San Francisco, a golden egg roll wrapped in an envelope of delightful pork bowels, spiced for our taste and our taste alone. So when you come shifting in with your fucking baseball cap and your shitty Crocs, you don't fit in. That's why when you go, hey, do you know where this is? People here go, no. Can you tell me where Fisherman's Wharf is? Yeah, I could if I wanted to. So I'm driving over the Bay Bridge tonight, and of course the fog already you can see from like Livermore. Just a swirling bank rolling in like Narnia, you know? A whole nother world awaits you on the other side, right? And this San Francisco was shrouded in mist like a tale told by an elder from a tribe now long forgotten, just crenellated spears poking up from underneath the moisture. And as you got further over the bridge, you could see Coit Tower peeking up, and then the ball yard with the lights on as the Giants once again attempt to defend their world fucking championship. San Francisco is a dream inside an opiated nightmare written by the Beats, extended by the hippies, formulated by the punks, disgraced by the dot-comers, and then once again embraced by all of us at the end of the fucking financial road, debt ceiling, beginning of this calamitous century. So it's awesome to be here. Let's take care of some old news on the Proopcast as we once again lie ensconced in the comfortable glow of the warming embrace of everyone here in the Bay Area. The last Proopcast, I believe I mentioned, I had a question about Julius Caesar. As you know, we hit on ancient Rome probably more than any other podcast in the world, except the history podcasts, which are boring and inaccurate. You want to hear mine, because I tell the real history. In any case, I believe I said that Sallust mentioned about Julius Caesar. It wasn't Sallust. Sallust is a Roman historian. It was Sulla, who was the dictator of Rome well before Julius Caesar. Sulla and Marius, of course, fought over Rome, and Marius was the one who tried to fuck over Sulla, and then Sulla ran the proscriptions, which were everyone was wealthy, had their house taken away from them, and names were posted on the walls of everyone they were going to execute and take their shit away from. Caesar somehow escaped because he was from a fairly rich family, although down at heels, and Sulla said of Julius Caesar, "I see many Marius in this boy," and then, of course, Caesar grew up to be dictator on his own, kind of like what's going on now in the United States. But the point is this, I wanted to correct that, and then here's another thing. I started a Paul McCartney story last week because I was in Montreal and Paul McCartney was playing up there. Now again, professionally I've banged on Paul McCartney for years, but just to set the story one more time, we were at the premiere of Wayne's World 2 in London. Yeah, that's right. This was right after the war and we'd showed Jerry a thing or two, and we were at the Wayne's World 2 premiere because I was invited by Neil Malarkey, who was friends with Mike Myers, having been in a comedy team with him. I was there with all of the Comedy Store players, who are largely the English cast of Whose Line Is It Anyway? They were having it at the Hard Rock Cafe, again, a perfect place to have a vegetarian like Paul McCartney. Linda was with him at the time, and she was much prettier than everyone says. She was, in fact, stunningly gorgeous. And my friend Richard Vranch was there with me, right? And we were high. It was after the movie. We'd had a couple drinks. We were having a cheeseburger and whatnot at the Hard Rock in London. And Paul Martin, the very famous English comedian, was engaged with Paul McCartney. And this was the point of my story. Richard Vranch, who's the keyboard player from Whose Line Is It Anyway, who's adorable and often high, was with me. And he worships the Beatles beyond all measure. Now, we disagree on many things, Richard and I, because he likes the Police. And as I've said, I would rather feed my own ears to a fucking dog than watch the Police at any point. Because the Police, first of all, their name's the Police. Now, if you were going to start... Thank you. If you were going to start a rock and roll band... And rock and roll is all about, you know, looting and shooting and snorting crank off a teenage girl, Snoopy, and all that stuff. And it's about, you know, pulling out a switchblade and stomping a dude and whatnot. I think, what would be the uncoolest name you could call your band? Well, that would be the Police. Why not call yourselves the fucking bloody Bureau of fucking Federal Bureau of Investigation if you really want to be uncool? So there we are, and Paul McCartney's talking to Paul, so I snoodles into the conversational circle, and Paul McCartney fucking turns to me and wheels, right, and goes, oh, right, you make up the stuff and brilliant, right, mate? Then Richard's standing there, and Paul McCartney, who I presume gets high all day and watches Whose Line at this point, turns to Richard and goes, and you... Brilliant, right, mate? You play the keyboards and the guitar and you make it all up. Bloody brilliant, mate. And Richard goes, excuse me, I have to go for a minute. And walks away. Paul McCartney is effusive, heaping praise on him. And he goes, excuse me, I've got to go. And walks away out of the circle. So we chat with McCartney for a few more minutes, and he's utterly charming, and then we all fuck off politely, right? Because you can't stay forever with someone that's famous like that. And I go over to Richard, who's sitting in the corner, literally sulking. And I go, Richard, what the fuck was that? And he goes, how do you tell someone they've influenced your life since you were 6 years old? And I go, you don't. Don't you think he knows that? It's like walking up to Bob Dylan and go, you've got away with words. Hey, Mick Jagger, those are some nice loose hips you're sporting there, bro-hame. I think Paul McCartney's pretty much aware that anyone over a certain age he's influenced since they were a child. So that was the end of the McCartney story. And I don't think I got my picture with him. I can't remember. I did get my picture with Mike Myers. I remember that because my left eye's closed in the photo. I'm wearing a tie. I've got my arm around Mike Myers. He's beaming. And I look like an unbelievable fucking half shut off light bulb drunk asshole. Like this. Hey. Wayne's World 2, as you know, disappointing at the end. We're very excited here at the Proofcast to have garnered enough listeners, and I hesitate to call you fans, because you may be out there just fuming while you're listening to the show, for all I know. I detest it when people call their audience fans. This is for all the fans out there. What am I, fucking Whitney Houston and shit? I presume if you're listening, you're being polite enough to give me a listen and then flip over to something you really like. But if you are listening, thank you. I would never call you a fan because that's short for fanatic. I like to think of the people who listen to the show as cranks who live in a van, who drive around with aluminum foil on their head all day and believe that the government is trying to fuck us with x-rays and stuff. That, I think, is my core crowd. After that, the disenfranchised who feel no one is speaking for them but me. And of course, I am speaking for you. Straight from the goddamn heart. But what's happened at this late date, 8 months into the Proofcast, is by golly, we've got a sponsor again. And I couldn't be happier. And so I'd like to plug our sponsor here, Audible.com. They're the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, informational and educational programming. Content from Audible is downloaded and played back on, really it is? On personal computer CDs or iPod player, it says. Or waffle iron, if you've trained your waffle iron to do that. But you can get books and papers, magazines, podcasters, business information. Listen whenever and wherever you like. Just like the podcast you're listening to right now. That would be the Smartest Men in the World Proofcast. 1,000 science and technology and 1,100 science fiction and fantasy titles, with more being added all the time, exclamation point. This is like getting a letter from one of my uncles. We took a hike in the Rockies. Timmy's really enjoying junior college, exclamation point. Why do relatives write form letters to you at the holidays? Is anything worse than a fucking form letter? I really detest them. We went to Knott's Berry Farm, and Terry really had a great time. Fuck you, Terry. Grow up. Here's the deal. You get a free audiobook download when you sign up for a free trial today. Go to audiblepodcast.com/smartest to get your free audio book today. I am currently reading Washington Irving's Tales of the Alhambra. I hope that's one of the Audible audiobooks they have. What's the Ross McDonald book you're reading, Jennifer? Anybody? It's one of the Lou Archer. Does anybody read Ross McDonald? Detective novels? Does anyone ever heard of a detective novel before? Wow, did I strike out on this one? I was trying to give Audible a fucking free plug here with a book. And you've all... What was it, baby? Anybody? All right, how about Raymond Chandler? The Long Goodbye. I'm almost certain it's available on Audible. Visit audible.com. Yeah, and you'll get a free audio downbook. Thank you for listening through that, and thank you, Audible, for joining us here. I'd like to pretend that my listeners, who I were about to call fans, are book readers, but apparently here in San Francisco, not so much. Greg, I've been on my phone all day, really looking at some important apps. I don't know if you've met famous people in your life. It's sometimes it can be heaven and sometimes it can be hell, right? I happen to like a lot of different, you know, when you meet someone that's overwhelmingly famous, you think to yourself, oh God, what am I going to say? You know, what am I going to do? Well, you shouldn't worry, because they're either going to be a knob or they're going to be totally cool about it. Like, I know Robin Williams because I'm a comedian, but I've met him and he's quite famous. And he's really nice. And he's nice to people. If you go, hi, Robin, how are you? He'll go, oh, fine. You know, like he says hi. Like he doesn't go like, don't look at me. He's not like, I don't know. Hollywood stars who can't have anyone in their eye line and wear a baseball cap pulled over their head, give me a huge pain in the fucking kidney. You know what I mean? Really? You can't just fucking go to the store without pulling your hat down and not having people look at you or whatever? Like I saw Michael Richards once from Seinfeld in the Whole Foods in Beverly Glen, and he was acting like he was being hunted by Hamas, okay? Like, he was acting like a squirrel in a four-day meth binge, just like... You know, and no, people are looking at me! Like, yeah, they're fucking looking at you. You're 6.5 feet tall with giant fucking hair, dude. You're famous. Embrace it. Smile at people and go, hey, what's up? Like, I saw Hank Azaria at the Whole Foods in Beverly Hills, and he went, hi, how are you? And I went, good, man, how are you? He didn't go like, don't look at me! I'm the voice of Apu! Like, he was able to deal. Now, ball players are a different matter, right? As you know, of course, I'm a white, middle-aged guy. I love baseball. And I've met several ball players. I've not met Willie Mays. Now, I know, I hear Willie Mays is hard-going, but he has every right to be hard-going. He was born in Alabama and during the Depression. So if he doesn't fucking want to talk to you, maybe you're a douchebag. How about that? Maybe have you considered Willie Mays' point of view and shit, that he's talked to a lot of people. And everyone goes, hey, Willie Mays, and no one calls him that. If you want to talk to him, hey, Buck, I think, or 24 is the way you're supposed to address him. In any case, I was on a plane once with Ernie Banks, and I never let Ernie Banks go, right? I'm on the phone with my wife, and I go, oh my God, Ernie Banks is on the plane. And all I hear my wife say on the other end of the phone is, you leave Ernie Banks alone. And I fucking hung up on her. 5.5 hours later, I called her again when we hit New York, right? Ernie Banks was cool as could be. So I'm on another plane with Frank Robinson, who once upon a time managed the Giants. In a very famous moment in Giants history, 1982. Some of you were just born then, but I, of course, was already seven. And cough. Frank Robinson, famously, we were playing the Dodgers here. We were about a game and a half back with about three to go. It was us, the Braves, and the Dodgers. This is the old glorious Western Division. The old glorious Western Division before there were 17 divisions in baseball and they had wild cards and stuff, right? When you had to actually win the pennant to win the pennant. So we're playing them. And Frank Robinson, bases junk, we're playing the Dodgers. Rick Monday's up. And Rick Monday is the... Dodgers announcer, Rick Monday talks like this. Well, there's a fly ball to left. That one's going to be grabbed. Like, he has that beautiful, mellifluous tone, right? Well, Rick Monday played for the A's, and he played for the Cubs, right? And he's tall and good-looking and blonde hair. And once upon a time at Dodger Stadium, a couple guys came out on the field and burned the flag, and Rick Monday ran over and grabbed the flag from them. And it was depicted on a Dodger ticket several years ago. I was at Dodger Stadium, and it was great moments in Dodger history, like Roy Campanella's tribute night, you know, Oral Hershiser's whatever, fucking Kirk Gibson's big home run. But one of them was Rick Monday with a burning flag in his hand running off the field. It's like, are we in Orange County? What happened here? Since when did stopping people from burning the flag become some heroic fucking moment or whatever? And I remember showing it to my friend, and he went, I'd almost forgotten that. Rick Monday's up, bases drunk, two down, Fred Brining on the mound, one of the few ball players from San Francisco that played for the San Francisco Giant. He was a sunset punk, right? Fucking hanging out at the 7-Eleven way out in the sunset where white guys will beat your ass for being a faggot. And, yeah, there's those parts of San Francisco, too. As well as being the liberal place where we all love one another, there's also parts of San Francisco called, you know, I don't know, where Dan White lived and shit like that. So there's lots of parts of San Francisco. Oh, Greg, really? Yeah, fucking really. You thought I was going to soften it up because I love you? I don't think so. What are you, my relatives? I don't think so. And, Fred Brining, he goes out to relieve him, and we had someone warmed up, I think Al Holland or Gary Lavelle or whatever, and Robinson, who hated pitchers, was a superb player, won an MVP in both leagues, hit 580-something home runs, was the first black manager, an absolute staunch, and a red ass at the highest caliber. Like, Frank Robinson argued constantly with everybody, umpires, second baseman, he fucking would hit knock guys over and shit. Goes out to the mound and says to Fred Brining, on the mound, we're about to win the goddamn division. You got yourself into this fucking mess. Now get yourself the fuck out of it. Next pitch, kaboom, grand slam by Rick Monday. And that was that, right? The next day we lost 15-3. And then the last day, Joe Morgan hit a home run and we salvaged some measure of fucking respectability. So I'm on a plane to New York. Frank Robinson's reading the New York Times. I walk over to the flight attendant and I say, do you know who that is? And she goes, I haven't the slightest idea. So I wait for the whole flight to end. Now I'm standing at the baggage carousel in LAX. Frank Robinson's at the carousel. Much shorter than I thought. Ernie Banks, gigantic. Fucking 6'4". Giant shortstop. And later first baseman. Robbie, shorter. I walk up to him. I go, excuse me, Mr. Robinson. I'd like to say hi to you. And he looked at me like I was a salad with a fucking lizard coming out of it. I said, excuse me, may I shake your hand? And I extended my hand. And he gave me the fucking frostiest paw in the history of mankind. Like, he literally acted like... it was like, honest, I don't even know how to describe it. It was like... it was like Kelly Osbourne at the library. You know what I mean? It was just like... really bad. It was like if Katy Perry had to sing with the Philharmonic Orchestra or something. Just uncomfortable, angry. He could barely be bothered to shake my fucking hand. And I almost said to him, hey, great job with Fred Brining in 82. You know, well done letting a fucking kid stay in there and give up a grand slam to a noted fucking slugger. That was some good managing, Frank. But I refrained. But more is the pity. I probably should have took him out. But some people are dead nice. You know, you meet different people over the years and you think, God, here's one that's not even my story. And I love to tell other people's stories because I tell them better than they do. My friend Brian Fielding is from Michigan, right? I think he's from Pontiac. I may be wrong on this. The point of it is this. He meets Stevie Wonder one day in an elevator. And he goes to Stevie Wonder, hey man, I'm from Detroit. And Stevie Wonder takes his hand and pulls him right up to him and goes, Detroit? Well, Pontiac. So don't pull that shit, you know what I'm saying? If you meet B.B. King, don't go, I'm from the country in Tennessee too. Because he'll go, really? Did you have to run a plow behind a horse and shit and learn to play blues on a fucking single string you pegged to your fucking porch? Is that what you did? White person who enjoys my music? Is really? That was your story too? Wow. What a coincidence. We would both share the same fucking story. How about that? So years ago, I'm doing a gig here with Alex Bennett. Some of you may remember Alex Bennett, who is in New York City and still broadcasting. He's on Sirius Radio. I did his show in March, and he just moved to Harlem. He sent me an email today. And Alex is a lovely man. I can't say how much he did for comedy here in the Bay Area once upon a time in the day, in the 80s and 90s, you may remember. He made Bob Rubin famous. He had so many comics on the show. Pardon me. And I was doing one of his comedy shows back in the 80s, and we were over at the Great American Music Hall, which is an awesome place in the Tenderloin, I would say. I remember seeing so many acts at the Great American... Gino Vannelli, that's how old I am. I saw, yeah, fucking Gino Vannelli, the sexy Montreal Canadian singer of the late 70s and early 80s, who wore a giant floof of hair, kind of a Styx level Dennis DeYoung hair from the 80s. You know, that irrepressible perm that says, I'm a rampant stallion, let me in you. unbelievably tight jeans and shit like that. I remember seeing him there. And so we're doing a show there. And what was his name? Alan Steven, I think it was. Part of Kennison's posse. So he was hardcore. And I go into the bathroom to take a leak. And we're smoking weed backstage. I'm too high. And I'm rarely too high. Because I'm not one of... when people come up to you and they go, man, you'll need one hit of this. I always think, you only need one hit of this. I have a Keith Richardarian tolerance level for Meryl. I have a Toots and the Maytalian level here. I need half a pound before I go on just so I don't want to fucking yell at the audience the whole time, okay? I have to have a certain amount of marijuana to eat breakfast, all right? So... Bullshit, it takes one fucking hit. This better be fucking purple kush that's delivered by a small child with a bald head and only one braid in the back, who's been on a fucking donkey up the Tibetan hills for the rest of the day, hitting a prayer wheel all day, infused with fucking golden locks of hash or whatever. It had better be fucking powerful to be only one hit weed. And I never respect anyone who carries a one-hitter. Fuck you and your one-hitter. Let's blast one, you know what I'm saying? Well, let me just do it. Because they're always gross and it tastes like char. And then they have to tap it out on the sidewalk and shit. And my favorite is when it's shaped like a cigarette and has cigarette markings on it. As if anyone in the world believes cigarettes are made of metal and never go down when you light them. Like there's someone out there watching, God, that guy's smoking an everlasting cigarette that only comes out the very end of it and it never gets any smaller. That's crazy. It couldn't be weed. Light a big fat one is what I'm saying. And I mean like, you know, lamb's bread, fucking, you know, Peter Toshian, giant ass, Snoop Doggy Doggian, you know. You know, let's go. Let's get this party started on a Saturday night. I don't want to have one hit and then go, well, now I'm mildly buzzed. I guess I'll drink. Because I do many marijuana benefits here at the Punchline. For what used to be called, awesomely, the Cannabis Action Network. And I let them book my flight once. And don't ever do that. I mean, really? I didn't know I was gonna fly Southwest to San Jose and shit, and then meet a guy named Kerrang and ride on a moped with him up the El Camino the whole way. Like, that's a circuitous route. What am I, the Dalai Lama escaping the communist Chinese? Couldn't I fly right to the city where the gig is and take a cab over and be here in 15? No. And I mean, I adore marijuana. And then the last time I did a benefit here, my very good friend Ngaio Bialim is a giant marijuana smoker and advocate. And the last time I saw him was in Portland, and he was wearing a marijuana lei, right? Like a lei made out of marijuana leaves. And he's wearing like a three-piece suit and glasses and dreads and shit. And he's got this marijuana lei on, and I'm like, you just don't care. I love that about you. Like, I love marijuana. I'm not going to wear a fucking headband with the word Chong Lives on it. You know? Free Tommy, man. You know, like... And marijuana, I find that I like marijuana and I like the people who smoke it by and large, but marijuana advocates give me a pain in my fucking ass, right? I'm here and they're like, will you do a video? Will you do this? Will you sign a petition? I just want to get high, let's be honest. Yeah, I hope it's legal, and I think the government's repressive, and the DNA is full of, DEA is full, and the DNA is full of shit. That's what the problem is. Some people have DNA that doesn't allow them to smoke marijuana, and they don't understand why the rest of us have to. Maybe it's a guanine situation. I don't know what it is. Your double helix doesn't even helix. Maybe it's just a straight line. That's why you don't understand how imperative marijuana is to life on Earth. The whole theory that marijuana makes you less violent, it's a great theory on paper. Let me point out a couple of things. The word assassin comes from the word hashish. Because the hashashin were given fucking hash and then they go out and fucking strangle people to death. I think you'll find reggae artists, not the most peaceable group that ever walked the face of the earth. Maybe some of you will cast your mind back to the Biggie Tupac wars of the fucking early millennium. They were all high as fuck and they still found time to load their gats and unload Roscoe's on one another. So I don't think it diminishes. I think by and large when people get high, they just want to watch TV and shit. Or color inside the lines for like hours, you know. I was talking about meeting someone, and if I can remember who I was talking about, I'll die a happy fucking man. I had a long area on the road today, and I'm red as a beet. Does anyone remember what the beginning of this story was? It was something about meeting Frank Robinson, and then I was going to amble on to some other gigantic meeting of a famous person, if I could think of who it was. It was in San Francisco here. So, I'm downstairs at Alex Bennett's gig, and I'm too high, right? So I'm drinking a Coca-Cola, which I rarely do. I like Coca-Cola, but like, as you know, when you drink a Coke, you're like, really? You know, like, they invest your body, and the next thing you know, you're just burping, and shit's going crazy, and your eyes are all fizzy. I don't know if your eyes get fizzy when you drink Coke. Like, there's really, when you see people slam them in commercials, like, oh, no, 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 no. Like, how can you drink soda pop that fast? Doesn't your upper digestive system just go like, ah, you know, like, and you're burping and things, and like my ears fill up with foam, and I don't get it. I mean, if you're going to put some ice cream in it, now we're talking. So I'm drinking a Coke, and I goes downstairs to use the men's room, and there's Alan Steven, and Dwayne, that would have been awesome. Dwayne Allman is there. This is 1973. I was wrong. It wasn't an Alex Bennett show. It was a Derek and the Dominoes concert. Barry starts this one off. Boom, 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 boom. No. It wasn't the Allman Brothers. It was Greg Allman. Duane had long passed, as had Butch, for goodness sakes. God rest their souls. And Greg Allman was down there with Alan, and they looked at me and they went, hey, you want a bump? And I know what you're thinking. Yes is the answer to that. Greg, you're an improviser. Yes and. The number one rule of improv is never say no. If they go, good morning, Dad, you've got an alligator sticking out of your ass. You go, yes, and you should have been there last night. That's how improv goes. It's not funny, just like I did it. And I should know. I should know how funny improv is. Greg Allman goes, you want a bump? And they both look up at me, and I went, I'm good. And I squeedled out of the bathroom. So I will never know how that evening might have ended. I know. Disappointing fucking story, that one. All right, let's go to a better one. I realized when I started the end of that story how disappointing it was going to be to the San Francisco crowd. You mean this doesn't end with you shooting heroin under your tongue at 4 a.m? Outside what used to be the I-beam on Haight Street. The I-beam was a great club, a long time. I guess it's been closed for ages now, but I remember going there in the 80s. We saw all kinds of bands there. And we would just go to dance. It was the first place I remember with giant video screens and dancing to like Duran Duran's Rio or whatever. But in those days, San Francisco was even more liberal than it is now, if that's humanly possible. Or let's just say lawless. You could smoke weed in the club and no one would fuck with you in any way. And Haight Street was a bombed out fucking zone of death in those days, right? You walked down Haight Street, there were old hippie gay bars on Haight Street. Hippie gay bars. Where you'd walk in and it was all gay guys, everyone with ponytails and long hair. Like, there's a fucking moment in time. And there was that one horrible liquor store on Cole that was open that was on Haight that had like bars up in front of it and shit. And then that place on Page that was like the White Rabbit mushroom place that was still there and shit, where fucking ancient hippies were still dealing. It was really good. And dangerous as fuck. I saw one homeless guy fuck with another homeless guy at the bus stop when I was waiting for the 72 one morning because I had to take it out to state, right? And the 72, as you know, an unbelievable bus ride. Next to the 37 Corbett, one of the more or the 22 Fillmore, one of the more exhilarating bus rides you can do. The 22 Fillmore, you have no idea what's going on. With the 30 Stockton, people used to get on in those days with chickens and stuff. Like, it would be, you're like, really? You can bring livestock onto a bus? Like, and never open the window. That's a bad air. Don't open the window. Bad air. So this one homeless dude is got the bottle of wine, and he's with his other friend, and he goes, let's pretend to drop it when the other one comes around the corner. So they drop a different bottle when their friend comes around the bus stop, and they go, God damn it, we fucking broke the bottle of wine. And the other guy goes, shit. And they're like, we fucked with you. And I'm like, really? This is like homeless agitprop street theater. So, holy Christ. I go into the bathroom at the I-beam, and I'm not doing drugs for once in my fucking horrible reprobate life. I'd smoked a J outside, and we're watching a thing, but someone is clearly doing drugs, because you can hear the huffing and snorting as if Charlotte's Web's cast has reunited. You know. Salutations! You know, and the next thing I know, I hear the bam! The fucking bathroom stall door's been kicked in, and I think it's the one I'm in. And I wheel around. Little Proops is still flying at this point, right? I'm like, I haven't had time to re-shank. And think, fuck, it wasn't my stall. It was the stall next door, and they were busting people for snorting drugs. And I thought, that's not the spirit. People are snorting drugs in the bathroom. Where would you like them to snort them? On the bar? I thought it was the very soul of discretion to snort them in the bathroom. So this isn't a drug one, but it is a good one. I was playing in Edinburgh at the festival, and the Bagpipe Torture Festival. And the Rocky Horror Picture Show, as you know, is a particular favorite, and I think people still go to see it. I don't know if they did as much as when I was young, back in the 40s, but when the picture first came out, the first time I saw the Rocky Horror Picture Show, we went to the I was living in San Carlos, as many of you are aware. I am matriculated in San Carlos, and San Carlos, very ancient Spanish city. It's where the discoverer Portola stopped for nachos on his way to Fremont. It's an extraordinarily white suburb. And I mean fucking white. We had four black kids at our school, and we knew all of them, right? Tony and his brother, and Stephanie and her sister. And till they started integrating, and then they bust kids in from EPA, which in those days was known as Nairobi. And no, it was called Nairobi. They called it Nairobi, East Palo Alto. And then we had riots at our school, which was awesome. So we're having riots at our school, and they brought the police in. And of course, some skinheads showed up just to show solidarity. Because if there's one thing that right-wingers will always do, it's foment racial hatred wherever it is, just to make sure that America's still on the right track. You know, the Jefferson Davis secession right track, the George Lincoln Rockwell right track, you know, all the great Americans. And the crowd goes quiet. This is San Francisco. That's uncool. Whatever. So we've been having riots for a couple of days. Because I'll be honest. I was like 15 and I was about 4'11" with giant glasses. So you can imagine how cool I was. Swinging. A bell buckle with a mushroom on it. Bell bottom pants. A t-shirt that had a peach thing on it. Remember those antique peach fruit logos that t-shirts used to have on them, right? And this one had a peach and it said eat me. So yeah, earth shoes. Yeah, you fucking heard me. Earth shoes went like that, right? The heel went the wrong way. Like, they didn't have heel on the back, they had heel on the front. It was better for you. No, it wasn't. And we've had riots for a couple days. They've made a few arrests. The news crew, like Carolyn, showed up at our school, so we couldn't have been more excited, right? The black girls used to scare the living daylights out of me. I had an earth science class, and I was maybe 15, and we used to listen to the radio in class, and it was, in those days, KDIA, which was the soul station, right, or KSOL. And they'd be playing, like, the Spinners, and I'd be like, could it be I'm falling in love with you, baby? My lab partner was a 6.5-foot-tall black girl with a giant afro, wearing a plaid mini skirt and a little fucking matching top, right? With a giant natural fork stuck in her hair. And she was from East Palo Alto and thought, what the fuck did I do in this life to get Greg Proops as a fucking lab partner? Why do I have a 4-foot-tall white guy with glasses who's singing the Spinners to me? The girls used to carry bim boxes, right? Big bim boxes, right? And they'd be playing like, in those days, you know, worlds keep on turning, but it won't be too long. You know, Stevie Wonder? Stevie Wonder was a musical artist. And I know. Your music sucked, Greg. Yeah, I know. It's not like the music of today. How could it achieve the lyrical poet... poetry of today's fucking musical artists. Ra ra hoo la la. Yeah, how come Stevie Wonder didn't think of that? What an asshole. I want your ugly, I want your disease. So I go into the locker room, and there's a black guy, and to this day I can't remember his name, and he goes, hey, you want to get high? And I'm like, fucking, to be sure. So we went out to my Chevy 2, which was a predecessor of the Vega. That's how uncool this fucking car was. But it did have bench seats and smelled entirely of bong water and rum. because I had a giant goldfish bowl pipe with an enormous bowl on it. It was a purple goldfish bowl, and I used to fill it with 151 rum and ice. And then, of course, it would spill inevitably when you get too high. And then the car smelled just like dank. Just dank. Like a Kentucky cave. Just like albino fish were like, oh, open a window, you know? So we went out and got high, and we traded weed, I remember, as a movement of solidarity. He said, like, everybody's fighting, let's not fight. I'm like, no, let's not fight at all, let's fucking get high. And Frampton Comes Alive came on the radio, I remember, what was it, woke up this morning with a wine glass in my hand. You remember that? Don't you feel like we feel, right? The fucking squawk box, talk box, the worst innovation of the 70s. Like, there's two songs with it. And like, Do You Feel Like We Do by Peter Frampton, because he does it for a year. And then Rocky Mountain Way by Joe Walsh, right? Where he goes, like, for a fucking year. Although Rocky Mountain Way is an awesome fucking song. And he came on and he went, man, that's the jam of the year. And I think I drove him to work or something. And then I had to go to Hillsdale to be a busboy at Mama's. I don't even think it's there anymore. It used to be above Macy's. Mind you, this is when ice covered the entire earth. So I'm going to Texas in a couple of weeks' time. In fact, September 4th, I'll be in Austin at a place called The Hideout for an afternoon proof cast at a place called the Out of Bounds Festival, where they have me doing improv and stand-up and all that. Well, I've never been to Austin before, if you can believe that. But Greg, you seem so uber cool. Surely you've been to a thrift store in Austin and perused a belt buckle with Poop Kitten on the label. No, I've been to Dallas and Houston, and a lot of my family lives there, but I not in Houston. They live in East Texas, that garden spot of America. Liquor stores and fireworks, this is going to be the best holiday ever. I'm drunk, and I'm lighting off shit that's illegal. And I don't mean fireworks like sparklers. I mean fucking rockets and M-80s and shit that reports, like Beirut. Like, you light it and BAM! And then it, ow, ow, ow! You hear dogs fucking, you know, like Kosovo. Fucking dogs have three legs and shit. Just horrible. So I'm playing Dallas. This is years ago. 2008. And I'm joking. No, it's well a long time ago. And I'm from San Francisco, right? So I bought this shirt on Haight Street, and it has giant white clown buttons on it and some kind of graffito, right? It actually said, and Tony Kameen, the comedian, figured it out for me, it said, spelled out in spindly white letters, "Kickin' suckas out." So it's this big old black shirt with white clown buttons. I have this green top coat that I bought in New York on sale when we were doing Who's Line there at some place in fucking Soho. So I've got a green top coat on, dark, dark black jeans, black boots, this fucking thing, giant black glasses, and lots of hair, right? This is like 1990, maybe, or something in Dallas, right? So I'm dying on my ass at this club. Well, one night, in comes this band, right? And they were a band called The Farm. And they did a song called All Together Now, I think was their big hit, right? And they had one other hit, if anyone can fucking remember it. And they were kind of a groovy, early ravey type band. There's like 100 of them. And they're from Liverpool. And they went, All Together Now was the song. So they came in, and they go, hey, Proops, there's some English, hey, faggoty dude with the glasses. And in Texas, right, incessantly in those days, you look like Buddy Holly. You know, like, really? Okay. And then the most awful thing, anyone, I think I've said this once before on the show, one girl came up to me and went, you look like the sax player from INXS. Who was the butt ugliest fucking guy in the band, but he wore glasses. Like, no, everyone in the world with glasses doesn't look the same, okay? There's a difference between John Major and Michael Caine and, you know, Ira Glass, you know? Like, we don't all look like Buddy Holly just because he's the only person in your fucking world who you recognize that wears glasses. There's lots of us. So I'm on stage, there's these English guys in tonight. They're from a band called The Farm. So I do all my English material because I've been over a couple times. And then they come up after me and we're chatting. And they're like, well, we're playing this club tomorrow night or whatever. So I do my sets, and I was playing with another comic whose name I will never fucking divulge. Put it this way, he was fucking killing every night, and he did a lot of jumping around and gyrating. He brought towels on stage with him to dab off like Louis Armstrong all the time because he was so energetic. Now, included in his act with all the singing and dancing were no jokes. Right? Nothing even resembling a fucking joke. And the opening act was another girl, and one of her jokes was this awesome rape joke. And I can't remember it. And this is before rape jokes were funny. So I would come on to polite tolerance, which is the worst thing any comedian can experience. I would rather have the crowd form torches and chase me out of town like the Frankenstein monster than be tolerated. There's nothing. I'd rather have them boo openly and throw shit. What I always want, of course, is unmitigated rave. Like, if I read a review, which, of course, I would never do, and there's a qualifier, like, that part was okay. Like, okay. Like, I'm like W.C. Fields. Unless it says exhilarating with 5 exclamation points, that's not a review to me. If there's any qualifiers, like, this part could have been stronger or this material was old, I'm like, fuck you. You get up here, and I'll go sit behind the desk and have no friends like you, you journalistic piece of fuck. If I wanted to sit in a corner and pretend I could accomplish it, I would have been a journalist too. So, of course, having said that, if you're reviewing the show right now, I want you to know that I think you're a sparkling wit, and I'm sure I'd like to roll with you and have cake and whatnot.
Let there be cake.
Let there be cake. And I does my show, and I'm tolerated by the crowd. Now, by Saturday night, I don't even want to go up anymore. And usually, I'm rather anxious to get up and perform my comedy jokes. So, you know, I do my show. So after the show, the guy says to me at the club, "We're all going over to Xenon, and we're going to see the Farm and Big Audio Dynamite, Greg. Y'all want to come?" And I'm like, hell's to the yes. I'm wearing my Kickin' Suckas Out shirt. Do I look like I want to partay? 5 minutes, Dougie Fresh. So I goes with them after the show, and I'm not feeling too hepped up about myself because I've been dying on my arse. I walks into Xenon, and everyone is wearing, because it's Texas in 1991 or whatever, everyone's wearing Lee Jeans and Tony Lamas, right? That's how they dress in Texas. It doesn't matter what kind of show it is. There's 3 goths in all of Dallas. And they sent me to Deep Ellum and then to some thrift store. And there's a cool neighborhood, you gotta visit it. Neighborhood? How about a shop? I'm from a whole city of cool. Don't fucking tell me there's a neighborhood when there's one shop and then a partial coffee shop next to it. That doesn't constitute a neighborhood. So I goes to the show, and immediately people are coming up to me going, "Are y'all from England?" Because I'm like not wearing Lee jeans. And I have glasses on, so clearly I'm Buddy Holly from England. Or an Elvis Costello impersonator. And by the way, if you're in Texas, Elvis Costello, wrong Elvis. So one of the Farm, they finish their act, and one of the Farm, Roy, the drummer, who's a lovely guy who became a writer, comes down and gets me and goes, "Hey, Proops, you want to go?" And I go, "Yeah, man, do I fucking want to go?" We go backstage, and next thing he knows, we're on stage. Now I'm on stage behind Big Audio Dynamite. And if you remember Big Audio Dynamite, what was their song? The horses are on the track. What was that one?
Bottom Line.
When you feed to the bottom line. Right, it was Mick Jones from The Clash. So Mick Jones from The Clash had a hip-hop band, and yes, they wore sideways hats. Yeah, this was then. So I'm on stage now, and the crew from the club, who has watched me eat what can only be described as a turd in purgatory every night on stage. I have eaten the most climactic turd that has ever been fucking presented. No one has liked me at the club all week. People are barely speaking to me. Now I'm on stage with a band, and I'm like, "Hi, you guys," and then look on all their faces, "What the fuck is he doing up there? We've never had anyone in the crowd like less. How is he on stage with the band?" So I goes backstage, and I've rolled 2 joints just against the advent of this happening. And there we go, and here comes Big Audio Dynamite and Mick Jones. And I was a big fan of The Clash, right? Because it was all about anarchy, and then later, of course, playing the US Festival. But the point is this. They were an awesome punk band. They really were. I saw them in San Francisco at the Temple Beautiful, which was right next door to the People's Temple in like 1944. And the stage was sagging and the balconies were sagging and shit. And they had a band on after. That was what was great about punk. The Clash comes on. Then after The Clash finishes, another band. And of course the crowd, boo, fuck you. And the band was like, fuck you, man. You knock us out. You guys blow. Like, no, we just saw The Clash. You know, really, you guys, whatever you're called. And they were like the Blenders or something. And The Clash was awesome. Joe Strummer kicking the mic stand, his eyes rolling back into his head, and they cut the guitar all over the fucking yard. It was really, really rocking good news. So the Big Audio Dynamite plays, and they come backstage, and I go, do you want to blow a spliff, mate? Huh? See what I do? And Mick Jones goes, too fucking right. And I light up a joint, and I hand it to him, and his arms were like thalidomide baby arms. I don't know how to describe. You know, that post-World War II English body, whereas my friend Andy Smart said, you could put the tines of a comb around their legs. Like, his arms were like, his arm came at me to grab the joint, and it was like, ah! Oh my God! If I give you a quarter, will you peck out a tune on a piano? Like, his arms were spindly and shit, like a squid or whatever. I was just afraid ink wasn't going to blind me, and then he was going to swim away into the blackness. Like, holy shit, how do your arms... You're like a sea creature or whatever. Holy kittens, his arms were small. Really fucking small. And so they let, and then they let the chicks in, and that was the end of that. I wasn't of interest anymore. That was a triumphant moment for me. The first time I'm in London, I'm driving down the street. A friend of mine says, meet me at the French House on Dean Street. So I take a black cab there, and coming out the fucking French House is Joe Strummer. And I go, oh my God, Joe Strummer. And the British cab driver, so it is. Thanks for making a young boy feel special about himself. We take questions on the show here. This has been such a shit week in fucking American politics. I don't even know where to begin. I was going to talk about it a lot, but I didn't want to harsh everyone's mellow, and I thought, fuck it, you came out on a school night here in San Francisco to see me in my beloved town. I just really... I mean, the whole debt ceiling thing has me beyond, 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 beyond. As I've said a billion times on the show, the corporations in this country pay no taxes. The war profiteers have been heedless and garner all the money they want. $5 billion in cash money lost in Iraq, and they're talking about cutting programs for everyone in this fucking country. Shame on the fucking government. And shame... And here's the part you're not going to like. Shame on... And happy birthday, Mr. fucking President. 50 years old and he fucked off to Chicago after having violent intercourse with the Constitution. He could have invoked the 14th Amendment and taken care of this in a fucking wink of an eye. But no, the Tea Partiers' balls were dangling in his face. And he had the need to lick them until they were ripe and fucking moist. Yeah, your little president that you went to Whole Foods and fucking voted for capitulated like the corporate fucking bitch that he is. Here's a few things that Obama has done since he's been in office. But what about all the good things? Yeah. Bailing out Wall Street while millions of Americans went homeless and hungry, extending the Bush tax cuts to the wealthy, enacting an ineffective new healthcare overhaul which puts more wealth into the coffers of insurance companies but does little or nothing for the sick American yet forces them to pay for this, failing to prosecute the Bush administration for war crimes including torture, increasing free trade agreements, continuing detention at Guantanamo, extraordinary rendition. If you don't know what extraordinary rendition, it means we can assassinate anyone we want because they're an enemy of our country and there is no legal recourse anywhere, not in the world court, not in our judicial system. This is President Obama's policy. Continuing the unwarranted and ill-advised war in Afghanistan and Iraq, I might add to that. Cutting or threatening to cut Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, which has no connection to the federal debt of the budget. Promoting nuclear power as clean energy. You may remember after Fukushima, oh, well, we're not going to stop nuclear energy. You may have noticed the country of Germany, not known for their liberal policies over the last century. No more nuclear power in Germany at all because of what happened in Fukushima. In this country, oh, come on. We can handle it. Really? A tidal wave hit a reactor. The reactor's still pouring shit into the ocean. This will last us the rest of our lives. We face the very real threat of having to deal with Godzilla during our lifetimes. highly risky offshore drilling, continuing warrantless wiretapping, prosecuting more whistleblowers than any other president. Yeah. Not Bush. Bush prosecuted whistleblowers. Obama's going after whistleblowers. So the time has come, my friends and fellow citizens of this country, to stop doing a few things, like fucking voting for people who misrepresent themselves, including Democrats. And I'm a screaming, poison, fucking, insane, faggot-loving, feminist liberal from this town here. I am a pot-smoking, drug-taking, flag-waving, tax-paying, fucking free-thinking asshole. And I'm telling you that we are not being represented in any way by any fucking party. The time has come to start other parties. Ignore politicians entirely. Don't listen to what they say and don't take what they say on board. Write them constantly and email them constantly and tell them you suck balls and you don't represent what I want. And I'm talking about the White House. The White House has a phone number and the White House has a fax number and you can email the White House. Never stop and never let Obama quit knowing that he promised hope and change, and that we've gotten was what this list I just read here. This debt fucking ceiling thing is the most shocking turn of events that I could possibly fucking imagine in my lifetime. Having said that, let's move on to some funner topics. We can force them to change, and we can do it by a million ways. One, when you see the Egyptians, right? This week, Hosni Mubarak was rolled in a bed into a courtroom in Egypt behind a cage. Now, a lot of people in Egypt were bumming out about it, going, you know, he was the leader of the Air Force during the 73 war against the Israelis. He led this country out after Sadat was assassinated and whatnot. But he's been a tyrannical despot for the last 30 fucking years. It's the first country in Middle Eastern history to try their despot publicly. How exhilarating is that to see democracy and, what's the word? Justice. Enacted. Notice all of the people from the last administration that started all the wars that have led us to this horrible point where we knew Obama had no fucking options but to go with the corporate fucking plutocracy that rules this fucking place, the plutocrats that call all the cocking shots. They're not being tried in any way. Can't we roll Dick Cheney in a cage into a bed somewhere? Even if it's just civil night court in San Mateo. Having said all that, never mind that. The whole world is political, and politics are only personal and local. Help the people in your neighborhood. Help the people around you. Fuck the federal government. They're not going to do anything for you. We must help one another, and we must lock arms and join together to give each other fucking health care and to give each other support and food and shit like that. If there's a homeless person in your neighborhood and you know them, fucking help them. That's all I'm saying. Never mind the government anymore. They're irrelevant to our lives. They don't want to do anything with us. They don't want to do anything for us. We have elected them and paid them lots of money. By the way, what's his name? Wiener, who got fucking thrown out? Who's that other cocking Republican who took naked pictures of himself and he got thrown out? They all get $1 million pensions. $1 million pensions because their censuring didn't include having their pension taken away. I don't know how much money you're making this year, but I'm not making $1 million and I don't have health care for the rest of my fucking life. Just like you, we have to help one another. But let me, having said all this and ranted and raved and been such a bumming, out, depressing, downer piglet, remember that when we help each other and we share with one another, there's poetry in the air, and that the world is a swirling ball of love, right? There's nothing else but love. It's the government and the media that will convince you that we're all against each other, and that the Tea Parties are assholes, and that we're fucking right, or that we're right, and that, you know, the Tea Partiers are assholes, however it goes. And thank you. Two people are on that one. In other words, enemies are created and fostered. I go to the South all the time and people go, really, Greg, do you like it down there? Yeah, man. My fucking family's from there. People in the South are just as intelligent and sensitive as they are anywhere else. Even people in the Central Valley, who I just made fun of in Coalinga, are fucking sensitive and intelligent. The world is not blue and red. We are all fucking here together. And one thing is sure, we're all going to pass into the fucking pink and perfect gates of the next world. And you want to be able to fucking count up when you get there, what you did in this lifetime. Even if there is no next world, even if you don't believe in an afterworld, maybe this world is the time to fucking do something. We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams, wandering by lone sea breakers and sitting by desolate streams, world losers and world forsakers on whom the pale moon gleams. Yet we are the movers and shakers of the world forever, it seems. With wonderful deathless ditties, we built up the world's great cities. And out of a fabulous story, we fashion an empire's glory. One man with a dream at pleasure shall go forth and conquer a crown. And three with a new song's measure can trample an empire down. We in the ages lying in the buried past of the earth built Nineveh with our sighing and Babel itself with our mirth. And o'erthrew them with our prophesizing to the old of the new world's worth. For each age is a dream that is dying or one that is coming to birth. Arthur O'Shaughnessy. And, of course, Willy Wonka. There's no such thing as a snozzberry. We are the music makers. And we are the dreamers of dreams. The government is irrelevant to your life. Do as thou wilt, as Aleister Crowley said. Shall be the whole of the law. We take questions on the show here. Sometimes we take them from the audience. I don't know if we have time. I'm going to run to the ones that we have here that we send on email. If you wish to query me, and I mean that in the nicest possible way, smartest@aspecialthing.com is the email address. Getting to that, we'll be back again August 17th in Los Angeles at the Bar Lubitsch on Santa Monica. August 27th, if you wish to visit me, I will be in Scottish land at Edinburgh at the Gilded Balloon there for a 7 o'clock show. September 4th in Austin at the Hideout. We are, of course, available on iTunes. And if you go to proopcast.com, oh, what a sexy Tumblr page I have builded. It's always free, except sometimes you have to sit through an Audible ad. But it's all free besides that. So here's the first question. Hey, Proops. Oh, my goodness, how familiar. I believe I've discussed before on the show, if you wish to address me, Ambassador, eh? Your Excellency will not go amiss, my lord. I'm egalitarian in my imperialism. You know, Nineveh, that Arthur Shaughnessy mentions in the poem here, was a lost civilization that no one thought existed. It's mentioned in the Bible, and I forget the name of their major king, but he was such a scary king that he posted on the walls, "I wiped out my enemies until the blood ran down the sidewalks and whatnot," and it has giant gates and whatnot, part of ancient Sumeria and everything. Babel, of course, we know all about. And that's what I'm doing. Here we go. Hey, Proops. Hey, Proops. Hey, you. I was wondering what your thoughts on the phrase, a comic's comic. Is there really such a thing? And if so, could you name a few? Thanks, Tyler. Well, hey, Ty. A comic's comic. Yeah, there is such a thing. When people generally say comics comic or musicians musician or actors actor or authors author, when they mean they're outstandingly good but the commercial world hasn't caught up to them yet and they're never going to enjoy mass popularity, that's what that usually means. It's the other thing that people say when they say, like, when Peter Cook died, I remember he was about, what, 54, 56, and all the British papers, well, he didn't live up to his potential. Well, he fucking wrote all the Pete and Dud albums with Dudley Moore. He did half many motion pictures. He did a fucking live stage act with Dudley Moore for 15 fucking years. What did he not fucking accomplish? I hate that when people say that. Oh, he never really reached his full potential. He died before he could. Fuck you. Maybe his full potential was one fucking thing. How about that? How about this? Your first novel's fucking hard to write. Maybe your second one sucks, because the first one you put your whole life into, and the second one you had to knock out 6 months later and shit. People go, God, why'd their second album suck? Because they spent their whole life writing the fucking first one, you asshole. There are many comics comics. Bill Hicks was a comics comic, and he enjoyed some popularity. But he didn't enjoy as much popularity as he should, because he was enormously honest. I saw him stand on this very stage and tell people they were fucked 8 ways from Wednesday for supporting the first Gulf War, the one with George Herbert Walker Bush, where we were going to really knock Saddam out, but we didn't because we wanted the fucking oil and we wanted to put the embargo into place to starve out all their people so that we could have this other cataclysmic war that would drive our country to the brink of fucking oblivion so that only rich people could have fucking money and the rest of us would go fucking begging with a bowl in our hands. He used to say, how come we have smart bombs, but we don't have bombs that could deliver food? Ever think about that? Bill Hicks was a fucking philosopher gentleman, and my favorite thing he ever said, less jokes and more me. But there's loads of comics. But I'm not that fond of the phrase, because I almost find it slightly diminishing. I know what it means. It means people are, like, excellent to the extreme where only other people in their craft can understand them. But let's see. Thank you for your question, Tyler. Dear Mr. Proops, now we're talking. I have but one question. Ida Lupino or Dorothy L'Amour? Cliff, is it? C-L-F? C-L-I-F? Cliff? Cliff? You only have one F at the end of your name, Cliff? Or is it C-L-Cliff? Interesting. Interesting question. We were discussing, my wife and I were talking about Dorothy L'Amour just yesterday in an extensive way. Really, were you? Fuck yeah, that's what my life's like. Dorothy L'Amour, you may remember, was the girl in all the Hope and Crosby movies, the road pictures, and she often wore a sarong. And they perved on her hardcore, and they tried to fuck each other over. The Hope and Crosby movies are indelible and very, very, very fucking funny. There's one, and I think it's the South Sea Island one, and they go, they get stranded together, the three of them, and Bob Hope says, I get you Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And Bing Crosby says, I get you Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. And Dorothy L'Amour says, what do we do Sunday? And they both go, rest. Maybe I find it funnier than you do. She was partially Spanish. I think she was Spanish on one side, which accounted for her unbelievable olive skin tone. And she was super hot in all the sarongs she wore. Having said that, I think I go Ida Lupino. Because Ida Lupino was tough, directed a bunch of movies. Go home and Google Ida Lupino right after we're done here now. Because she directed pictures that were film noir. She's in a bunch of amazing pictures. She's in an astoundingly weird picture called Lights of the City with... Dana Andrews, and Dana Andrews is openly drunk on screen in it. It's one of the few pictures I remember where someone is drunk on screen. It's set in a bar. I'm almost sure to cover the fact that fucking he's drunk. It's a Fritz Lang movie, and he has a TV show, and he's a journalist, and there's scenes where he, and you know, drunk people don't go like, hey, and sometimes they do when they're douchebags. Mostly drunk people are trying to maintain. So Dana Andrews is delivering his lines like this. I'm afraid I have to go and do my television program in 5 minutes. Ida Lupino must weigh like 85 pounds. She really is stick thin. What's the fucking picture with her and Olivia de Havilland where they're the wicked sisters and they live in... It's a gothic movie and it's in the 1800s. If anyone can come up with that, I'll look it up for next time. Ida Lupino. And she was a movie director, and they never give credit to any women directors. When Catherine Bigelow won from San Carlos, California, 2 years ago for that awesome Iraq movie, which wasn't a genius movie, but she had the fucking balls and temerity to make a movie about a war we're in for 10 years. And of course, Hollywood, well, we always do that. We're conscious of, no, you're not. Fuck you, Hollywood. You fucking blow. If it was up to Hollywood, everything would be Green Lantern 18. Only indie films and people independent-minded make any fucking films worth a shit. Don't even fucking bullshit me. But in any case, Catherine Bigelow is the first woman to win a fucking Oscar. At this late date, in this calamitous fucking century, we've had cinema for, what, 115 years, and we finally squeezed out an Oscar for a woman? Holy shit. Like, 3 black people have won ever? You know, give me a fucking break. That's why the Oscars are hilarious. So Ida Lupino, thank you. If. Dear Sir Lord of Comedy Proops, now. Where is my pipe and where is my bowl? And where are my fiddlers 3? Sir Lord of Comedy. You have talked about both Satchel Paige, ooh, now we're talking, and Gwyneth Paltrow. If you are a frequent listener, you will know somehow Satchel Paige has worked his way into every goddamn Proopcast through no doing of my own. Very, very outstanding pitcher from the Negro Leagues. What were the Negro Leagues, Greg? Google it, bitch.
You mean once upon a time, black people didn't get to participate?
Yeah, this is America. We were built on that. They were forced to build the country, then we kept them in bondage and servitude as their reward. Then we elected one, and look, he sucks corporate ass. Go fucking figure, huh, ladies and gentlemen? Oh, everybody relax. You can go home and read Glenn Beck. Oh, what did I do? Oh, I see. You can only go one way but not another. Why don't I do the show in Berkeley next time and people can hiss? You can go on your blog and diminish me after.
Fucking Proops was a dick. We need rendition.
You've talked about Satchel Paige and Gwyneth Paltrow. Well, there's an odd couple. During your podcast, if you had to live one of their lives, whose life would you choose? Ooh, that's an outstanding question, Matt. Thank you, Matt. Wow. Well, you know, Gwyneth has a privileged life, and she grew up the son of the son. She changed sex at 11, is my understanding. She was born in the gelatinous sack some 40 years ago. In a swamp outside of show business land. The president of show business came down and touched her on the head with a wand and said, not only will you be an unbelievably, unwarrantedly rewardable actress when you're far too young to earn one, later, you will be given a singing career for no reason whatsoever. Then, later, you'll have a self-help blog that you don't write. That some intern writes where you'll tell people how to live their lives and say things like, putting a wood-burning oven in my backyard was one of the best decisions I ever made. You mean not having your children? That wasn't the best decision? You mean the wood-burning oven was better than having your children? Okay, whatever. Value judgments, whatever. So I'd kind of love her life, because she obviously has a $350 haircut, which is awesome. And she has good legs, although her middle body... You know, when you're with a woman, you don't want to think, did I hurt a chicken? You want to think, boom, boom, out go the lights, as Pat Travers once suggested. Paige's life was unendurable hardship, but God damn it, he had a fucking sizzling fastball. He beat Bob Feller regularly in black-white all-star games. I'm going to have to go Satchel Paige on this one. Thank you for asking, Matt. We'll run through the rest here. I think we've crashed the hour mark and way past it here. Should the... Producer... Oh, the producer's dad has questions. Well, this is a break with fucking convention. The producer, Matt, his dad wants to know, why don't you just have him fucking ask me, Matt? Three questions? Well, let me just pick one here. Who should start on your all-Jewish Major League Baseball team? Koufax. There's my left-hander. Eddie Ruhlbach pitched for the Cubs. The last time the Cubs won the World Series, that was 1908. Yeah, have fun in Chicago, Obama. And, the Cubs had a pitcher on that team named Peter Centennial Three-Fingered Mordecai Brown. Lost his index finger in a threshing accident, so he had a devastating fucking curveball. Pitched with the nub, right? Just the name, Three-Fingered Peter Centennial Mordecai Brown. Eddie Ruhlbach was on that team. First base? I don't know. Fucking Mike Epstein? Gabe Kapler is an outfielder, I'm guessing. Rod Carew, the Panamanian All-Star. Jewish. How about that? He plays short. Second? Shortstop? Cock. Let me come back to that one. I'll mark that one. Ron Bloomberg, DHing. I'm going to need to go through. Epstein at first. Who's a Jewish catcher? For fuck's sake. Perplexing question, this one. It's like the book Great Jewish Athletes. Pretty quick to get through. If it's about great Jewish violinists, it's going to take a while. Coming back to that one, and I'll see if I entertain your other two parts of your question. Thank you, Matt's dad, who doesn't have a name. Adorable Mr. Proops. Oh, well, chatons du monde. If dark powers conspired to abduct and abandon the smartest man in the world in an uncharted pathless wilderness... Oh, dude, I'm going there. I'm going to Pittsburgh in 2 weeks. Kidding, Pittsburgh. Look, Andy Warhol's from Pittsburgh. Exactly. Far from any traces of civilization, what would be his preferred survival strategy? Well, first, I tried to find someone who was holding. And second, who's going to clean the Prada boots? They're going to get dirty. Oh, that was Kanzanet. Oh, look at you, Kanzanet. Where do you live, Germany? You're always writing in German to me. Currently muddily yours. You must be in Germany. I'll come up with a better answer for that one. Thank you, Kanzanet. All right, one more question, and then we're going to fuck off. Let's see. Let's hope it's lucky. I don't read these beforehand, so let's see if this one's good. Okay. Here we go. Dear Mr. Proops, can you please review the correct French protocol for greeting one another before abruptly asking if they speak English? Sincerely yours, Dennis Steenbergen, expatriate in Stuttgart, Germany. Well, if you're in Stuttgart... what need of you to greet people in French? First of all, you're in Germany, so I would say, like, Guten Tag, Guten Morgen, you know, like that. And then, you know, Ich bin ein Berliner, which I'm led to understand means I am a jelly donut. The correct French protocol for greeting one another before abruptly asking if they speak English. All right, here's my experience. Americans are parochial and countrified. We are, in fact, the hillbillies of the world. Now, I know what you're thinking, but what about Australians? Well, besides Australians. And thank goodness for Germans, because we used to be the most hated, but... go to Europe. I think you'll find when we roll in, they're like, oh, thank God you're not German. Because German people come in and go, we would like to sit here! You know, at least we're not like that. We're like, can we please sit here? And do you have burgers? You know, we're like that. We're friendly, at least. Every time I was just in Montreal, right, and French Canada, and the rules are kind of the same. They're at a show business festival, and people who have come from show business from America, from New York and Los Angeles, have the slightest idea how to address any French Canadian. When you walk into a place in French Canada, they go, bonjour. Well, then your response, as a human who's a member of the planet Earth, bonjour is what you say back to them. And then if you can manage it, comment ça va? And then they go, ça va bien. And then you go, that's it. And then because you're in French Canada, everyone speaks English because everyone has to speak both languages. So then you go, hey, I want this. And they go, okay. It's just that easy. But see the politesse of saying bonjour first instead of they go bonjour and you go, I want stuff. How about breaking out of your... Now, mind you, I'm talking about people from show business. So this is what is going on inside of someone from show business's mind. Me, 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 look, me, me, me. Look, there goes Mars, there goes Jupiter. The entire universe revolves around me. Bonjour, me! So they can't break out of that at any point. Now, you're a normal human. You're probably not in show business. If you're in Paris, right, you walk into a place, French people sing. They sing to you. They sing hello. Americans go, hey, what's up? Or, hi. Or in L.A., of course, hey. Hey, substitute for hi in L.A. Hey, 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 what's up, hey. Here in San Francisco, hi. And then the San Franciscan. Yes. When you go to France, people sing. You walk into a store, bling, bling, bling. That's the bell of the store you're walking into. The person behind the counter goes, bonjour. They sing it on three, bonjour. And then what you're supposed to say is, bonjour, back to them. And then, parlez-vous anglais? Do you speak English? And then they'll go, ouais. And then you go, oh, merci bien. And then, may I please have some stuff? And when you meet someone in Europe, and they're European, and they're being introduced to you by another European, when you kiss them, you don't give them the one-sided kiss. It's the same in French Canada. Both sides, right? Even in England, which is an island off of Europe. When you kiss them, you go, kiss, kiss, on both sides, right? Both sides. If you do the one, and you wait, they're going to conk you in the head. Which happened to me a million times in Europe. You go, ah, bonjour, and then bonk, oh fuck. I forgot we were going for the other side here. So that's the proper protocol. And then when you leave, merci bien, au revoir, right? A bientôt, whatever, au revoir, goodbye, right? And when you're in Germany, like, I don't speak German at all. Sadly, I look German. I wish I looked like Marcello Mastroianni, the unbelievably sexy Italian movie star. We all in our minds fantasize what we really wish we looked like. But I look like a fucking German person. If you go to Berlin, you will see, and you won't believe this when you go, a bunch of people that look like me. Not that many people look like me here, but if you go to Berlin, you'll be like, Proops. Oh, no, it wasn't fucking Proops. Why are there so many fucking Proopses walking around here? I mean, dudes with glasses and curly hair, a mole hair, the same fucking look as me. Seriously. In a suit. So I would go, I learned some simple phrases. Guten Morgen, right? Guten Tag. And then I go, like, here, there's one kind of sausage called a Krankauer, right? Eine Krankauer, bitte, right? I would like one fucking Krankauer, please. I didn't say I was good at German. I just learned this one phrase. And then when they give it to you, Dankeschön. And then they go, bitte. So I would go, eine Krankauer, bitte. And they go, nein, du darfst nicht, hast du dann. And I go, nein, sprechen Sie Deutsch. And then they go, ja, ist denn wirklich ein bisschen, and carry on. And then I'd have to spend a whole conversation going, ja, ja. Sehr gut. And then, oh, no, no. Just pretending I knew what they were fucking saying. So that is the way. We have other questions that we did not get to. I thank you very much for those. We hope to get to them next week. And Matt's dad, I will go through yours as well. Oh, Christ on a cracker. I'm not reading that one. In any case, we'll be back August 17th. I'm all weekend here at the Punchline. This Proopcast drops on Friday. I will be here Saturday. And then Sunday I'm doing a show called Previously Secret Information with Joe Klochik. I hope you can come and see me on that as well. Thank you very much for coming out to the Proopcast tonight. You are beloved to me. My name's been Greg Proops.